Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
And now, from the University of Chicago Institute of Politics and CNN, The Axe Files, with your host, David Axelrod.
You know, it is easy in these rancorous times to take a very dark view of where we are as a country. And then you meet extraordinary people who have made an enormous difference in the lives of others. And it makes you realize that there are so many good things that are happening out there. And this week, I want to talk about the Special Olympics on its 50th anniversary, and I do so as the father of a Special Olympian. Today we're going to be talking to Tim Shriver, son of Eunice Shriver, one of the founders of the Special Olympics. Tim has taken it global, and millions of people have benefited from this program in a really touching and important way. Like his mom and his dad, Sergeant Shriver, Tim is a force of nature who has a lot of great insights, not just into how we treat people with differences in our society, but the broader questions we're facing. I had a great conversation with him. Here it is. Tim Shriver, welcome to Chicago, back to Chicago. I know your family's played a big role in the history of this city. We can talk about that. And welcome here for the 50th anniversary of the Special Olympics, which is of personal meaning to me, as I am the father of a longtime Special Olympian.
And a very good one.
Yes, she's. Yeah, if those medals were actually gold, she would be Fort Knox. But what's more valuable to her is the experience that she's had in competing, and I'm really grateful for that. We will get to that. I want to talk a little bit about your own journey. And as is probably known to you come from two famous families, in a sense. You're the larger family being the Kennedy family. Your mom, Eunice, was the sister of President Kennedy and Robert Kennedy and Ted Kennedy, and part of this family that has a kind of a mythic role in American history of the last 60 years or more. I sat down with your cousin, Caroline Kennedy, who's a dear friend of mine, and made the mistake of trying to talk to her about all of that. I felt like a North Korean interrogator because it was so obvious that, and in retrospect, for good reason, why she doesn't really like to revisit all of that. Tell me about what it was like to grow up in that family, in the larger family, and then I want to talk to you about the Shriver family, which has its own unique identity.
Yeah, well, I mean, of course, no one really knows anything other than their own experience. So I only know one family to grow up in, just like everybody else only knows one family. So I have nothing to compare it to.
But most don't do it under the glare of public scrutiny at all times.
Yeah, I just wouldn't know what it's like not to. So, yeah. But anyway.
How does that impact you, actually?
Well, I think it in two ways, I'd say. The first is, I think it growing up in my family, we were always invited to think big, to think that, you know, seemingly impossible things were possible, to think that maybe against all odds you could do something incredible and the whole world might pay attention, because we'd seen this happen in our parents' generation over and over again, actually. So I think the upside of growing up in a family that has the privilege of being listened to or paid attention to or followed in some sense is that as a little kid, you start to think, well, all, you know, impossible things are really possible. I mean, the downside is, you know, you sacrifice a lot of family. I mean, you lose your parents a lot. You're alone a lot. You're never really clear on who you are as opposed to who everybody else is. I've spent my whole life with people asking me, which one are you? And that's okay. I'm sort of, after about 45, I finally got used to it. Finally developed enough of an internal spine to be able to handle complete anonymity and personal confusion and not being understood or known as an individual. But, you know, one of the great privileges of life is to have a family that in some ways defines you, that helps you, that supports you, that you're a part of. People are looking for belonging. People are looking for intimacy, for relationship, for the power that comes from the group. We got a lot of it. Sometimes we maybe it seems like too much, but it is a privilege to have parents and uncles and aunts like I had.
You also, as a family, experienced a lot of loss, and you wrote in your autobiography in 2014, a couple of things that really struck me. You said one time when I was four, my mother came home to tell me my uncle had been murdered and I should run along and find something to do. And you said about these losses, and I don't need to rehearse what those losses were. Everyone knows them. That through those losses, I learned one of the most problematic lessons of my childhood, grief and other emotional traumas are not to be dwelt upon, and in fact are barely to be acknowledged. We had one unspoken rule as children: deal with loss on your own in whatever way you can. That is a very tough lesson.
It is. Everybody has loss. Everybody has...
But most people don't have to face that. Suck it up thing.
Yeah, we did. Yeah. I think that's, I don't think my parents' generation had the tools or the understanding of loss or grief that, you know, maybe we take for granted in today's day and age. And so they were very much focused on the fact that we all had a faith that we shared that promised clarity and safety and in some future that we couldn't quite anticipate. And that after that, the rest was to be... just move on. You just keep going. I mean, I got that lesson over and over again as a kid. You know, somebody would die and you just, okay, now you go sailing. And I'm like, well, wait a minute, you know, but you know, keep going.
What did you have five children, grown children, you and your wife, Linda. What did you learn from that experience that has impacted on your own parenting?
Well, I think Linda and I parented differently than our parents, all four of our parents, I should say. I think we tried to create much more of a open language around emotion, you know, a good emotion, positive emotions, negative emotions, they're all okay. I think many in our generation have raised children to believe that it's healthy and important to be able to express your emotional feelings at different times in your life, to be able to manage your stress, to develop strategies around that, to be able to connect with people when you need help, to seek help. Mm-hmm. So we've spent a fair amount of time trying to do that. I'm not sure how far you get, you know, because we're all the victim of our parents. And I think at various times my kids would say...
I've experienced that.
Yeah. Yeah. I would say at various times our kids would say, you know, Dad, you never made this possible, or Mom, we never talked about that. You know,
yeah,
we
but
tried,
at least they can say that.
Yeah, that's right. At least
that's
they can
an
say
important that. Thing. Yeah, you know, to have that dialogue. Your parents were luminescent figures, each in their own way. Your dad, Sergeant Shriver, was very much identified with the initiatives he led: the Peace Corps, VISTA, the War on Poverty, and was a really as you describe him so vividly in your book, but he wasn't a bullying character.
Yeah, he was
in every
full of
way.
Exuberance. I find it ironic that just last week the current administration declared the war on poverty over because it had been successful in eradicating poverty from the country.
Yeah.
Some 60 years later.
They got to get out more.
It's unbelievable. It's a different point of view. My dad was animated by an extraordinary faith. He just kept it so strongly in his center of his being. And by
his Catholic faith.
His Catholic faith, and by his belief that every person had a certain kind of spiritual strength and faith and openness and willingness to give of themselves. I mean, that was his big conviction, and my mom's too. They both are known, actually, if you think about it, David, as people who created movements driven by volunteers. In other words, they both understood that to ask people was not just a rhetorical or a political idea, but a concrete solution strategy for changing the world, for creating peace between countries that are at war. Ask young Americans to go live with them, to end the discrimination against people with intellectual disabilities. Ask young Americans to cross the street, to enter the institution, to break down the wall, to play together. Ask people to create early childhood programs. So ask the mothers to come into the Head Start centers, volunteer and get paid to actually make sure their children get early supports that would make it more likely for them to be able to learn optimally. I mean, both my parents believed in faith as in the broadest possible sense, that everybody's got one, tap into it, pull it out of people, invite them to find their best selves by giving themselves away.
Yeah. Well, and this sense that we are about something larger than ourselves is important. That sense of the larger community of man is an important concept. He embodied that. I want to talk about your mom extensively in a minute, because it obviously is related to this cause that you've come to commemorate on this visit. Your dad, I remember, because I was an admirer, watching your dad's funeral, and Bill Clinton spoke, and he said something that struck me about both. It probably was revealing about both himself and your dad, but he was running Texas, the state of Texas, in 1972 for George McGovern. Your dad was McGovern's second nominee for vice president, his first, Tom Eagleton, having to leave the ticket because of the disclosure that he had been treated for depression, a sad episode in our history. But your dad took on this task. It was not a winning proposition from the beginning. And Bill Clinton said he came down to Texas a few days before the election, and he had this zip in his step and this great enthusiasm. And he said it was really hard for me to understand, because he said, if you're in politics, you know that the worst thing next to death is losing.
Yeah.
And,
I think for my dad, the worst thing next to death was not competing and not being in the arena. I mean, he just wanted to be in the action. I mean, I remember driving to work with him. When we moved to Washington, we lived with my parents for a short period of time. And they lived out in Maryland, and the office was downtown. I was driving down one day, and I said to him, wouldn't you and mom like to move downtown? You could be close to, or move the office, I shouldn't say. I said, move the office out where you live. He said, hell no, I want to be down where the action is. This was at 87. So my dad wanted to be in the arena, and he wanted to be in the arena for things he believed in, and he wanted to almost mysteriously communicate his deep belief to others. And so, being asked to run for national office on the ticket, I don't think he evaluated it according to the odds. I don't think he looked at it according to whether his political future would be helped or hurt by it, whether he would be enhanced or diminished by the association with Senator McGovern. I think he saw it as a chance to share his enthusiasm for the country he fought to defend, the country he fought to build up, the country he fought to make better. He wanted in. I mean, he just wanted in.
Yeah, he also, I suspect, because of his faith, and maybe because of the loss that your family experienced, understood that there actually were things worse than losing an election.
Yeah, much.
As competitive as he was. He also did a stint overseas when you were a kid as ambassador to France. Tell me about that. And what, how that experience impacted on you?
Well, we moved to France when I was, you know, 8 years old. So I was a little kid. I didn't want to leave. I had friends, you know, all those kinds of things. But we moved, and it turned out to be fantastic. I lived in Paris and rode the subway and ate French pastries. In the meantime, of course, the country was, we moved in 1968, you know, in the spring of 1968. We came back, of course, during the summer of 68 as little children. France itself, Paris, was undergoing enormous turmoil. There were riots in Paris in that period of time. The peace negotiations to try to end the war in Vietnam were going on secretly in Paris at the time. Avril Harum and Cyrus Vance were negotiating with their North Korean counterparts. All that was, of course, missing in my life. I was, just a kid going in and out of various elementary schools. But I think in some ways it impacted all of us, my siblings and I, in the sense that we, you know, we'd heard about the Peace Corps, we'd heard, but now we were living in a new country, learning a new language, seeing different cultures. It wasn't radically different, of course, from the United States. Mm-hmm. Paris is not exactly a developing country, that's for sure. But at least we started to see that the ways in which we could learn about other people were could be natural and joyful and hopeful. And I think all of us, my siblings and I, we have enormous affection for France, I think, as a function of having lived there at an early age, but also an appreciation for what the global platform of the United States can and should look like.
Yeah. That's what I was going to ask. Did you get a sense of how the world looks at us?
Well, in those days, the world admired us. I mean, the United States was the global icon to Europe, certainly. I mean, we went to the commemoration of the invasion of Normandy at just, I think it was the 25th. You know, this was a recent event that the United States had liberated France. Charles de Gaulle, the general who was in charge of the World War II French resistance, was the president of the country. So World War II is a very vivid and active memory for the French, for the Germans, for the English. The United States, I mean, my dad was the ambassador from the United States of America to a capital of Europe, a capital that had been liberated by Americans, a capital that had been reinvested in by Americans, a capital that loved the United States. The great stars of French film and television would sing songs about the America, and nightclubs were, you know, you'd go in and be an American and people would toast you. So it was a different
probably
time.
Probably to salute the fact that you were an 8-year-old in a saloon. But,
you weren't supposed to pick that up, but we did. The laws were loose when it came to bouncers.
But one of the things that strikes me, I went and saw your uncle, John F. Kennedy, when I was 5 years old, when he was running for president. And it was in this housing development, and I apologize to people who've heard this story here before, Stuyvesant Town in Manhattan in New York, and it was built for returning war veterans. It was the middle of the day, as times were what they were then. Most of the men were at work, and mostly there were young moms who were with young kids, and I was one of the young kids who was there. But his rhetoric very much was about not our individual opportunities, but the opportunities of the country, and not about what, as he famously went on to say, the country could give to us, but what we should give to the country. And I realized this was a whole generation standing in front of him who had sacrificed enormously to save the country from fascism, to work through a Great Depression. And there was this sense of not taking for granted the future. Something I think that my generation maybe is a little bit guilty of. We were handed something, and we take for granted that it is enduring, but it's only enduring if you are willing to invest of yourself in it.
Well, obviously, couldn't agree with you more, David. And I think the challenge of taking for granted the country, or trying to get everything you can out of the country, or having a sort of a selfish or greedy approach to the country, I think is overstated. I think average Americans still give enormous amounts of time to their faith-based institutions, to their civic organizations, to their neighbors,
indeed.
People who are in senior.
Well, you've seen it yourself.
I've seen it myself. And I think the story of the American citizen activist, the citizen politician, if you will, the citizen who's committed to the future of the country, to his or her community in and of itself, I mean, that story is still alive and well. We don't see it. The media misses it still largely, I think, in my view at least, skirts over it, looks for the big headline, looks for the clash, looks for the conflict. There's plenty of clashes to be had. There are plenty of clashes to be had, but there's plenty of good stories to be had too. And if you look at this generation, I mean, the work I do around disability, intellectual disability, inclusion in schools and early childhood centers and healthcare, I mean, it's a booming transformation in the country right now. We're right in the middle of probably the greatest revolution on this, on the part of this community in the way education takes place that's ever been held. Maybe, you know, you could say 94, 142 when the schools were forcibly, if you will, integrated. But now we're seeing relationships change. We're seeing friendships grow. We're seeing sports teams burgeon. We're seeing employment opportunities and transitions from school to work. I mean, things that we never dreamed were possible. Those of us like you who have been in this, lived this life for decades, and if not, you know, centuries past. But no one, you know, again, it's not a headline story. It's a slow burn story. It's the slow transformation of the culture, the country, our hearts and minds. But it's a very, very good story, in my view, at least. So what President Kennedy invited people to do in 1960 or 59, maybe you saw him during the
60,
campaign.
60, it was 10, yeah. 12 days before the election.
So
in New York City.
Did you give him a line, or did you give him a strategic shift that made the difference in Chicago?
I was not a strategist in that.
Yeah, well, I'm sure you are.
But he was encouraging an ethic of service.
He was encouraging an ethic of service, but he encouraged an ethic of service that didn't feel like a duty or a guilt trip or a burden. I mean, people came to Washington after his election because they were so excited, right? I mean, they were like...
No, I saw some of the same after the election of President Obama.
Yeah. I think President Obama did... inspire, particularly during the campaign, that same ideal that you know, I could go into this work of building up the country and I will be happier. I will find meaning in my life. I will see the purpose, not just in my country in a nationalistic or in an arrogant way, but in my country as an ideal that the whole world could, you know, to play some part in. Does it sound jingoistic or, you know, arrogant? Maybe it does to some, but to others, it sounds like an invitation to find your best self.
You have a quite a educational pedigree. In between there, you flirted with the priesthood. You taught for 15 years. Mm-hmm. Why did you choose teaching? And again, it's not that I'm avoiding the discussion about your mom, but she's so central to the second half of our discussion.
Yeah.
Why did you choose teaching, and why did you leave teaching?
Well, I didn't leave. I just changed. I changed job descriptions a little bit, but I didn't leave. I chose teaching, I think, because I'd grown up around people talking about making a difference. Policy, big ideas, speeches, grant forums. But I wanted something a little bit more hand-to-hand. I wanted to look a child in the eye and see if I could make a difference, if I could tilt my little tiny piece of the arc of history towards goodness, towards justice, towards opportunity, towards equality. I wanted to get underneath the skin of the rhetoric I'd grown up listening to and try to make a difference in a more personal, at a more personal level. So for me, the most powerful institution in the country is the school. It's the only place where almost every American family has an interaction with. It's 13 years in the life of the average child. It's 10 months a year, seven some plus hours a day. I thought to myself, if you want to try to make a difference, if you want to work on the peace and justice and equality issues that my parents and their generation had been talking about in the day-to-day, it seemed to me that the school was the place to go. And I still believe that teachers are American patriots. I still believe that teachers are the most profound people who can affect the life of a community outside, of course, parents. I still believe that schools have an enormous capacity to build a more inclusive and a more healthy future. So I left the school system because I thought I could teach more and better, honestly, through the Special Olympics movement. I thought I could teach the same lessons I was trying to teach in classrooms through the experiences of unlocking the gifts and potential of people with intellectual differences and allowing them to become, in effect, teachers on their own, of their own gifts, of their own message. And I saw that as a very, you know, it's the same lesson I was trying to teach in a classroom. I thought I could teach through these playing fields, and they have more than fulfilled the bill.
Let me Let me ask you about public service. We met first when your brother Mark was running for Congress. I worked for him. I was doing his media. You were directing me. It was everybody. Everybody had their role.
Only once.
Everybody had their role. But
jeez, you have to remember that.
have you considered public service? Why haven't you taken it up? You're performing enormous public service, not just here, but across the world. So let me stipulate that and save you the bother of doing that. But I'm talking about running for elective
office. You know, I really never thought that political office was for me. I thought I wouldn't be good at it. I thought I'd be much better at doing what I'm doing. And I think I was right. I think this is the right work for me. I think it's important. I think it's, for me, it's fulfilling. I feel like I have a front row seat at the best of humanity, and I like it. I don't like the divisiveness. I don't like the vicious, mean-spirited nature that politics has adopted across the country. I don't think it's healthy. It doesn't make people happy. It doesn't make people good. It makes people angry, scared, anxious, depressed.
But how do you change this vicious, mean-spirited nature of politics if people of goodwill are just so disgusted by it that they don't run for office and try and change?
I think it's a great question. I don't know the answer to it other than I think we need almost every system in the country has been,
That's okay. Go ahead.
Has been changed by the generation we're living in, except the political system.
I want to introduce everyone to the world of podcasts. Authentic, real. That is a cell phone going off. Tim's wife, Linda, is trying to kill this cell phone even as we speak.
Yeah, so I think we've got to get new and better people in, but I think we got to get, you know, when the system is as gerrymandered as it is, when it's so polarized, when the congressional districts are so pushing to the extremes of both parties, when the leadership in Congress and so on is so aggressive about using every possible issue as a weapon against the other guy, we need some kind of a breakdown that will allow us to rebuild. I think we're hitting the end of the potential of the system as we know it right now. I mean, we see it right in front of our eyes, the system dissembling every single day. We don't know who the president is loyal to. We don't know who Congress is loyal to. We don't know who the Democrats, what they believe in, what Republicans believe in. We're watching the dissolution of politics as I grew up thinking of it. I grew up with the party lever. I grew up thinking Democratic values were consistent, were powerful, were important, were right. I grew up thinking that, you know, if giving myself to the Democratic Party was giving myself to a cause larger than myself. I don't think there's a 15-year-old in America. I mean, maybe there are. You probably know them. But I don't think there's many who at 15 would approach either political party. I don't mean this.
There's a healthy skepticism.
I think there's a healthy skepticism. And I think it's. I think we need fresh eyes, fresh ideas. I have cousins that have gone into elective office. I have brothers who have sought elective office, obviously uncles, and I admire it. It's super important. Nothing could be more clear now how important elective office is and how we need good people. But I just chose a different path.
And that's the path you're going to continue down?
Well, it's the only path I know, honestly. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's... I would love, if the question is what I like to have the ideas that emerge from the athletes of Special Olympics and their unified partners be paid attention to in public discourse, yes. Would I like to have schools become places where we educate the head and the heart, which is my professional work? Yes. Would I like to see inclusive healthcare, as we're working on in Special Olympics through our work with the Golisano Foundation and others around the world, to end discrimination against people with intellectual disabilities in healthcare systems, all disabilities, actually? Yes. Do I find myself sometimes constrained by people dismissing me or these messages as just the message of a cause or a charity or thank you very much, I'll give you $20 and I'll leave me alone? That drives me nuts. So I'd like to have our voices more heard in the public discourse. But how to do that? I'm like everybody else.
How's
so I call you and say, yeah, David, what should I do?
How's this administration doing on these issues?
Well, I mean, it's hard to know, honestly. I mean, in our work in Special Olympics, we try to promote social inclusion in schools. The administration's budget has eliminated the limited tiny little bits of federal funding we get every year, but the Congress, Republican-controlled Congress, restores it and grows it and believes in it. I meet with Republican members of Congress all the time. They're full-throated supporters of the idea of making social inclusion a standard of American education. The Secretary of Education has been a supporter of the Special Olympics movement. So, I'm like everybody else. It depends on what you listen to on any given day. Mm-hmm. Is the work moving forward? Yes, it's mm-hmm. moving forward in very important, I think, ways. We are listening to the margins in schools now, people who have sat in the short bus and sat in the special ed wing and sat alone at the lunch table, they are coming into the mainstream. Their voices, even if they don't speak, are being heard and listened to by their peers and their teachers. It's a beautiful transformation. Are politicians, is the administration on top of it? I would say hard to believe that that's the case.
Let's talk about your mom. And as part of talking about your mom, who I had the pleasure of meeting when I was working with your brother. Talk about another character who played a big role in her life in the memoir you wrote, and that is your aunt Rosemary.
Yeah. Well, I think I'm the only one in my family who might say this, but I believe that the inspiration for President Kennedy's Ask Not, for my Uncle Bobby Kennedy's persistent commitment to people living on the margins, to my Uncle Ted's long career in the Senate fighting for inclusion and so on, I think they all came from Rosemary. I think it came from being raised early age with a sister who was excluded by the culture.
Tell for people who don't know, tell her story.
So my Aunt Rosemary was born with an intellectual disability in the early part of the 20th century, 1921, I believe, if I'm remembering correctly. This was an era when people with intellectual disabilities were routinely institutionalized, sterilized against their will, allowed to die in neonatal wards, and so on. So it was a very draconian, very harsh period. Eugenics was capturing the public attention in very open and explicit ways. In that context, 9 children my grandparents had, and they decided to keep their daughter at home. There was no school for her, no doctor for her, no therapeutic program for her, but they kept her at home. So there they grew up. Jack and Joe and Bobby and Teddy and Jean and Pat and Eunice and Kathleen all grew up with Rosemary. So every day they woke up and saw that there was no school for their sister. And every day they were told by their mother, if you're going out to play, touch football, or go sailing, you include your sister. So these powerful words, include your sister, I think resonated through almost the DNA of that generation. And I think there's good enough evidence, at least from my point of view, that President Kennedy and my mother, for sure, felt not just the anger that came from seeing their sister treated unjustly by the culture, but also the intense joy they got from being with her. And so, I think the first moment in which the president might have thought that it was better to give than to get was probably sitting on a sailboat with their sister Rosemary, having been told to take her sailing and having learned that he could find his best self by giving himself a little bit to someone who needed support.
Her story is one of challenge, not just because of the intellectual disabilities with which she was born, but also because of decisions that were made on her behalf.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it was a tough time. So my grandfather, who was a fix-it kind of a guy, he was a take-no-prisoners, very successful businessman, a cutthroat operator, and a very active political actor, and so on and so forth, in the 1920s and 30s, in the Roosevelt administration and others, he wanted to fix his daughter. He wanted a cure. He wanted to get things done. He wanted to make life better. So he was all about getting the solution. So at one point, he was advised by doctors that by giving her an operation on her brain, that maybe they could correct everything. This was after dozens and dozens of other strategies, you know, medications and therapies and so on and so forth.
So
in her early 20s, she was given a prefrontal lobotomy, which caused her to lose her speech and a lot of her mobility for the rest of her life, and significantly made her more challenged than she had been beforehand. So it's a heartbreaking story. I mean, it's a terrifying.
At first, she was sent to an institution in upstate New York.
For a short time, but then to the nuns in Wisconsin, where I just visited.
St. Coletta's.
To the nun, Sisters of St. Francis, my grandfather built her a house there, which I just visited a few weeks ago. It's a beautiful place. She had a beautiful life, like every young person in some ways. She rebuilt her life there after leaving home. You know, it's a heartbreaking story in some ways, David, but in other ways, it's a story of its time. And it's a story where I would say, at least for those first 20-plus years, she was able to inspire people like my mother, who would then give the rest of her life.
Did your mother, I read somewhere that your grandfather never visited her, and I had a hard time understanding that.
Yeah.
And maybe you can explain it.
Well, I have a hard time understanding it, too, honestly. But I think the best sense I have of it is that he was so deeply ashamed of himself, probably, mm-hmm. and so deeply ashamed of what had happened that he couldn't bear the pain. In all likelihood, that's my only guess. But was there a calculating political? You know, people want to attribute all kinds of malicious things to my grandfather. Obviously they have the right to say whatever they want. But I think when you look at what all Rosemary's brothers and sisters did with the rest of their lives, the commitment to disability rights and the ADA, the commitment to mm-hmm. 94-142 and inclusive education, the work of Special Olympics to transform hearts and minds all over the world, the tireless efforts of my grandmother to visit institutions and locate rehab centers and places like Misericordia here and to support financially all this work, it's clear to me that their love of Rosemary never diminished, but it was in some ways... I think changed by her
and did your mom and her brothers and sisters, did they visit her and see?
Well, my mother did. I mean, Rosemary was a constant guest in our house. She'd come 2-4 times a year for a week or 10 days, mm-hmm. Stay with us with a nun, and my mother would go back out to Wisconsin. So we grew up with Rosemary, probably the most common visitor to our house, more than any other aunt or uncle or my mom, I think it, particularly after the election of President Kennedy, saw her opening to sort of pull Rosemary back, you know, almost from the dead, I would almost say, you know, that she had been in some ways lost to the family, but my mother was determined to resurrect her. Mm-hmm. And so she literally put her on airplanes and literally brought her to the dinner table and literally took her into the swimming pool and literally made us walk with her and give her spend time with her in the living room and so on, in order to confront all that pain with her own determination to change it.
And it wasn't just that, because she did many other things, even in those early years. Talk about these events in your backyard. When I went and visited with her at your home there, your family home, Mark was telling me about this that you wrote so beautifully about these events when people with disabilities, young people came, and kids without disabilities and played.
I mean, I just was with one of the volunteers who was 16 at the time when the Camp Shriver was started in 1962. She's still around, has wonderful pictures of those days. I mean, you know, my mother basically had one too many calls from a mother of a child with an intellectual disability who said, "There's nothing for my kid."
Yes.
And she just heard it one too many times. She'd heard her mother say those words, "There's nothing for Rosemary, nothing."
Tim, I can remember so vividly my experience as a parent and that heartbreaking sense of not being able to provide my daughter with... the activities that other kids had and the loneliness that was associated with that. So I very much appreciate.
I mean, that's what my mother was not a parent, but she was a sibling, and she saw her own mother with that heartbreak, and she saw her own sister with that. And I think it was some combination of those things, and she just got that one phone call that were too many. And she said, well, hell with it. You come bring your child to my house. We're going to have a summer camp right here. You can't get your child anywhere else. Come to my house starting next week. And I don't think she had a clue where that was going to end up. But I think she had the fierce determination to overturn that horrible shame and loneliness experience because she knew it was unfair. You know, she knew it was unjust. It just wasn't right. You know, it's not like circumstances provided for these things and you just have to live with it. No, she didn't see it that way. She said, this is wrong.
Now, maybe this is an indelicate way to describe it, but just having met her, reading what you've written about her and stuff, she wasn't very laid back.
No.
She was kind of a pile driver. When she was committed to a cause, she moved a lot of heavy furniture around.
She was a force of nature. She was formidable. And she didn't really need much validation for her ideas. She shaped them on her own, and then it was up to the rest of us to try to keep up. Because, I mean, even the first games here in Chicago in 1968, just 6 weeks after my Uncle Bobby lost his life, I mean, who wouldn't have decided to postpone? Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, the Mayor Daley, the city was tense, race, violence, poverty, the war in Vietnam. I mean, these were things that were toxic at the time. Dr. King and my Uncle Bobby both having been murdered within the previous few weeks. I mean, most people would say, hey, let's put this off. Not her. She knew what she wanted. She wanted to change the world for people with intellectual disabilities, and she was determined. She just saw it from within. And, you know, when people see things from within, it's a different kind of mission. You know, it's you can almost detect it in folks. They're like, oh, you know, when that person walks in the room and they know what they want and they're not negotiating, they're just, as you might want to say, pile driving, your job is to either get out of the way or help. And my mother inspired people to help. Some people got out of the way. I mean, people would often say that, you know, even in the Senate, you know, Senator Hatch was fond of saying that if ever he wanted something from my uncle, Senator Kennedy, he would just call my mother. And because he knew that my uncle, Ted, could never say no to my mother.
So, you know, here in Chicago, we associate the Special Olympics not just with your family, but with Ann Burke, who's now on the Supreme Court here, who was at that time a playground instructor and worked with kids with disabilities and saw the need. Talk about how that all came together.
Well, I mean, Ann is an absolute hero of our movement and a hero of the larger disability rights movement. She got, you know, she was hired on a grant that my mom gave the city of Chicago because the Park District had no adaptive physical education and no programs for kids with special needs. So my mom and the Kennedy Foundation, the small foundation that she was leading, gave a grant, and they went out to look for a physical education person who could work for the summer and work with kids with special needs, and Ann was hired. So the link between the two of them goes back really to the beginning of Ann's career. And Ann, from everything I can tell, just had the same kind of fierce determination. She'd knock on doors. She'd go down to the big shots in the Chicago Park District and union halls and so on and say, I've got an event. We've got you. We need you. And people would ridicule her and say, that's outrageous. How could you put those kids on display? This is embarrassing. This is shameful. And she just saw what sports and play could do. Let's remember the primary way in which human beings learn is through play, from infancy onward. And Anne and my mom both had this common conviction that in play we could do a lot more than score goals on a soccer field. We could learn about one another. We could transform the way we think and feel, get out of our heads and all the ways in which we're judging. What's your syndrome? What's my syndrome? No. On the field, you're a striker. You're a goalkeeper. You're a point guard. You're a breaststroke swimmer. Whatever you are, you get a new identity. And Anne knew this. You know, she knew that if she could get those kids out from behind those shadows and let them play, that the city would see them and the mayor would welcome them and the unions would applaud them and the powers that be might say to each other, let's change the city. And that's exactly what happened in 1968.
One of the things that makes me happy is that she sits on the Supreme Court in the state. And it's good to have someone on the court who sees the world through those eyes, who sees people who others might look past. I think it makes us a more just place. So talk about, from 50 years ago, talk about how this movement grew. And you have been extraordinarily successful in growing it well past the borders of this country. It was already global by the time you took over, but you've taken it to a whole nother level.
Well, I think the way, you know, people say, how did it grow? It grew because the idea is irrefutably resonant in the hearts and souls of human beings, no matter where they grow up or where they live. There's something about a Special Olympics invitation that says, I've got something extraordinary for you. And you may be a volunteer or a coach, you may be a sponsor. Everybody thinks they're giving to the athlete, but almost there's not a single volunteer I've ever met who doesn't say, oh my God, what I got back. Mm-hmm. The sense of purpose, the sense of joy, the sense of lacking in judgment around people, just the chance to be free for, even if it's for an hour or two, of all that dualistic, negative, stereotyping, judgmental.
And one of the things about these Special Olympians as a class is they're the least judgmental people in the world.
They've been judged the most harshly, and they tend to be the least judgmental people in return. Yeah. And that's true, in every country. So, you know, today, David, the movement is cradle to grave. We start at 6 months to 2 years old with programs that support early childhood development. We continue through schools and all the way through the life cycle. We have programs that empower our athletes as self-advocates. We have health programs I mentioned earlier. And these are programs that are growing all over the world. I mean, our next World Games will be in the heart of the Arab world in the United Arab Emirates, where there's never been an Olympic event of any kind.
When will that be?
That will be in March of 2019. I hope you'll come. If you're not, it's not in an active election cycle, so there'll be a lull.
I'm retired anyway.
You can do whatever you want. Now, We can do some good podcast. I mean, that's an interesting country. They've got a minister of tolerance in that country. They have a minister of happiness in that country. They have a minister of youth in that country. It's not because the country's perfect, but the country is on an agenda of transforming itself into a place where an ancient religious tradition, Islam, an ancient political culture that comes from the desert there, can become a modern, contemporary, tolerant, open democracy. I mean, it's not there. No one there would say that, but it's a fascinating
place.
Is
it like the larger Olympic movement in that countries compete for?
I wish they competed more. We it's more of a partnership. In we do get multiple bids for World Games. Mm-hmm.
World leaders, if you're listening.
Yeah, if you're listening.
Yes.
We've got the 2021 games, winter games, which we're still finalizing a site for, and then 23. We'll be looking for, we've got some interest from Russia for 2023 and Germany. So we'll see how these things land. But we don't cost anything like the Olympics. We're not, we don't build stadiums. We don't build museums to ourselves. We don't have billion-dollar, television contracts and all that kind of stuff. We just bring the best of the human spirit.
Let the record note that Mr. Shriver just went negative on the whole Olympic movement. But, I have to say that having been to more than a few of these events, more than I can count, I can personally attest to what you're saying, that the joy of the participants and the joy of the volunteers is palpable, and it's not just the participants who end up stepping on the platform to get medals. Right. It's the joy of competition. It's the joy of being with each other. And for the volunteers, it's the joy of giving and receiving from them. It is really a remarkable thing to see, and worthy of support in every way. Now, talk about you've been transforming the mission
Yeah.
In some ways, or at least building on it.
Yeah.
Talk about that.
I mean, I think the main message of our movement today is that we're a movement not just for people with intellectual disabilities, but from them. And the idea of a movement that focuses on inclusion, most of our growing programs are what we call unified. So the team might be a relay team in a swim race or a soccer team or a basketball team. Half the members of the team might have an intellectual challenge and some kind of difference, and the other half don't. But they're learning the sport as teammates. They're competing as teammates. They're winning and losing as teammates. And all of a sudden, the labels and the stigma starts to yield at a whole new level. And all of a sudden, Special Olympics becomes a movement not for people with intellectual disabilities, but for everybody. And so my wife, Linda, you know, started a local unified sports basketball team when our kids were young. And all five of our kids played on Special Olympics teams for 10 years, every year, every winter, as athletes, not as volunteers or as coaches or as donors, not as though they were coming just to help, but they came to play. This is a future that, you know, I like to think we've got a Title IX type movement in front of us. Maybe we won't get the legislation that Title IX produced that allowed girls to have equal access to sports that boys. We think that's shocking that it didn't exist, but it did, and it required a federal law to change it. Maybe we don't need a federal law, but I hope someday every high school in America will have a boys team and a girls team and a Special Olympics unified sports team. And young kids with Down syndrome who are 5 foot tall will get a varsity letter for playing basketball, and they'll be roasted and toasted at pep rallies, and they'll be written up in school newspapers, and they'll be heroes of the school walking down the hall and on the bus and in the lunchroom just like any other kid might be. I think sports can do that for us. So we're very much in the inclusion revolution way of thinking these days. And so we're kind of expanding the universe of opportunity to people all over the world. Join the inclusion revolution, pledge to be a person who grows up learning how to include, play unified, learn to live unified. You know, sometimes people say, well, it sounds like you're getting political. And I said, look, we're not partisan. We don't have a system of government we support. We don't have a party platform. But if being inclusive is political, then we're political. Because we will not compromise on that, and we will not allow our athletes to live half a life, and we will not tolerate the injustice and discrimination that too frequently persists.
You know, I want to talk to you about, and you and I have had some discussions about this before. You know, I heartily embrace what you're doing. I having lived these issues, I have my own perspective on them. We moved. Specifically moved to a community that included our daughter in classes from the time of middle school through high school. And the challenge of it was that not only were there big sort of gaps in intellectual growth that and capacities, but also, and maybe more important, in emotional growth. So the things that 15-year-old girls were talking about were a lot different than what my daughter was talking about when she was 15.
Right.
And she found herself gravitating to peers who shared her experience and so on. So I guess where that left me was that we ought to create a world of options and choices.
Yeah, I don't think inclusion means any one particular strategy. To me, inclusivity is a way of thinking. So people sometimes would accuse Special Olympics of not being an inclusive worldview. When people come to these events, there may be only people with intellectual disabilities on the track, but that doesn't mean it's not inclusive. That doesn't mean it's not respectful. That doesn't mean there's not room for difference. I like the term diffability because it's actually more scientifically correct. Your daughter may have some things in common with other girls or women her age, but there may be other people who she also has things in common with that have very different patterns and ways of thinking. People with Down syndrome are not the same as people with autism. They're not the same as people with Williams syndrome or people with seizure disorders and so on. So different abilities to make the country safe for difference, to end discrimination against people who have disabilities and replace it with respect for diff abilities is to me the sweet spot. I don't prescribe to anybody whether they have a disability or not, where they belong on a sports team or where they belong in a school, they should absolutely have choices. But inclusivity, in my view...
How about where they should live?
Where they should live. I visit communities
that are... This is a battle that I've had.
Of course, you know? I know. And there's a lot of ideologues in our field that feel very strongly that only one solution is right. There are vulnerabilities to the large congregate care facilities.
And we've seen those.
And I'm sure you've seen them. No. But there are vulnerabilities to the loneliness of isolation.
You mentioned Misericordia. My daughter lives there. She and she has such a full life. I can tell you that 20 years ago, we were worried if she'd even survive because she had epilepsy and she was cascading downward. Mm. And, when you have a child with these kinds of struggles, you reach a point where whatever your vision was the day that child was born, what you hope for and pray for is that someday they'll be happy and healthy every day.
Right.
And my daughter is happy and healthy every day, and I'm so grateful for that. And she is in a larger setting with a very great place with lots of individual kind of options for people within it. But she feels like she's part of a community.
Yeah. And but that's what's missing for so many people in the world today. Forget whether you have a disability or not. I think people don't like larger group living facilities like your daughter's in for one reason. They think they're vulnerable to creating abusive relationships between staff and residents and those kinds of things.
And as I said, the history of it is there were such places.
There were
Misericordia was born because Sister Rosemary Connolly, who runs it, was to take on the direction of the Archdiocese, take young children who were sick. She was caring for them and had disabilities to the state. Mm-hmm. And she took the first one over there when they were six, looked around, took the child back, and said to the Archdiocese, we are not going to send
that
these
place.
Children
yeah.
there.
Yeah.
And she created instead this loving environment. So we all ought to fight abuse. Right. And by the way, not just in large settings, but in smaller settings, because we've seen abuses there as well.
Of course. But loneliness also is a plague.
Yes.
For our population.
Yes.
And
yes, it is.
And, you know, you have great examples of community living, Misericordia, but also the L'Arche communities that are growing up around the world, which were founded in France by Jean Vanier, who's a living saint, where people with and without intellectual disabilities live in community together in homes designed for their shared community life. I mean, these are models that people are attracted to, and we should always be wary of labels that stigmatize, isolate, and humiliate, but we should not be so strident in our view of what the right or the wrong solution to that is that we don't recognize love when we see it, and we don't seek belonging and community when we can get it. And for our population, as well as for the rest of us, I mean, you say your daughter's happy and healthy. I have five children. That's all I want for my children, too.
Yes, I have two others, and I wake up every day hoping for the same thing, but the odds for her were longer.
Of course, but all I mean is, to hope for and to have that be an outcome on any given day. I mean, it could change tomorrow, right?
Yes.
You're a dad, I'm a
for
dad.
For any kid.
For any kid. No. But on any given day, to think your children are happy and healthy is the greatest joy you can have.
Yes.
So she's living in a place where she's happy, where she feels belonging, feels a sense of purpose, maybe has work that she likes.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the brass ring.
Yeah.
Or the gold medal, I should say.
You should, exactly. I can't finish without talking about your siblings because you're not alone in giving back. And my daughter was also a consumer of Best Buddies, which was a program that your brother Anthony started. Your brother Mark is a leader of the Save the Children Federation. Your sister, Maria, famously active on issues in relating to women and girls.
Mm-hmm.
You have all taken the lessons of your parents and acted on them, and your faith.
I think we've taken, and my brother Bobby also has raised over $100 million to help the Special Olympics movement grow throughout Africa and Latin America and so on.
Who I met when he was a fine young reporter for the Chicago
Daily News.
That's right.
When we were young. I mean, I think the thing, you know, people say, well, your parents taught you to service. I think we've all, I think I speak for all my siblings, that the work you've just described is the best work you could get. There has been nothing but joy from this work. Anthony's extraordinary work with Best Buddies all over the world. Mark on advocacy for children. I mean, Maria on women. Alzheimer's Bobby with the music and entertainment world, trying to bring their energy with Bono and others to issues like AIDS and disability. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is work that is, you know, lucky you if you can get it, and lucky us that we did.
Well, as we recall the Special Olympics, the inception of it 50 years ago, let us remember your mom and her indomitable spirit that that made this possible. And I just want to thank you on behalf of my daughter and so many others who have benefited from this incredible program over so many years, where you've changed lives, which, as you say, is the best work you can get.
Well, thank you, David. It's a sacred trust. I think no matter what your religious tradition or nationality, people come to this work feeling that they've been given a sacred trust. This is at 50 years. It's our chance to give our legacy to the next generation, to hand it on in a way that the movement is strong, that it is a movement, not just a program, that it is a way of life, a holy, if I can even use that language, mm-hmm. way of life, where an open heart and a generous and gentle heart allow people to see the world at its best and to hope for the best and bring out the best in others. These are gifts that the world needs now more than ever. And so we head into our second half century confident that we've just begun, that this population of people has a lot to teach the world, and we intend to give them the chance to do it.
Well, maybe the best way to sign off is to recall the words of your uncle, that here on earth, God's work must truly be our own. You're doing God's work, and we're very appreciative.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to The Axe Files, part of the CNN Podcast Network. For more episodes of The Axe Files, subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast app. For more programming from the University of Chicago Institute of Politics, visit politics.uchicago.edu.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.